about a spring or an itch. Pain that's swelling or twitch. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director and Physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. So, what can you do on a radio show whose main purpose is to educate and entertain with nothing but medical information? Well, you need to scour the internet news, not only for current information, but information that will help those who are listeners to the show. There's a lot of medical news out there, but the majority, such as the current news from the medical journals, then simply are just informational to the majority of people, with the utility of that information being minimal for the majority of the population. Of course, COVID is still in the news, and even more so now that the numbers have again risen throughout our country.
Apart from the norm, with the viral pandemics that the world has suffered, there is no evidence that the virus called SARS-CoV-2 that causes the COVID-19 disease is transmitted through a small number of venue types, such as restaurants, hotels, and religious venues.
As a matter of fact, these seem to account for the majority of infections. One thing that this model seems to help explain is why infections disproportionately affect people living in deprived areas. The most recent model of COVID transmission, done at the Stanford University in California and Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, really provides a tool for identifying high-risk venues and testing alternative paths instead of lockdown. Now, most of us do not want another lockdown, as this in itself seems to decrease the general population's well-being, even when it may decrease the number of COVID infections and COVID-related deaths.
The researchers use anonymized location data from cell phone networks to reveal the movements of 98 million people in the United States during a period of 2 months starting in March of 2020.
The team modeled the number of infections occurring hour by hour at around, 553,000 venues, which they grouped into 20 specific categories according to use. And they also factored in the floor space of each and every venue. Their simulations accurately predicted daily confirmed infections in 10 of the largest metropolitan areas, and these include Chicago, New York City, and San Francisco.
The model suggests that reopening gyms, full-service restaurants, cafes, hotels, and religious venues leads to the largest surge in infections due to the high density of people and their long lengths of stay.
Interestingly, the model found that 10% of all the venues in the Chicago metropolitan area accounted for 85% of all infections. So maybe this is good news, since the model indicates that capping the number of people allowed into venues at any one time is more effective and less disruptive than uniformly reducing everybody's freedom of movement. For instance, the model predicts that limiting the occupancy of a venue to 20% of its maximum capacity reduces new infections by more than 80%.
It seems that you can achieve a disproportionately larger reduction in infections with a small reduction in visits. So precise interventions like this may be more effective than less targeted measures while incurring substantially lower economic cost.
The research discloses that we can choose different levels for different types of places. And the model provides a tool for policymakers to basically navigate these trade-offs and make the right decisions for them. Now, with all this in mind, let's look at the statistics relevant to disadvantaged groups of people. The model accurately predicts higher infection rates in racially and socioeconomically disadvantaged groups.
Again, statistics showed that people within these groups were found to reduce their mobility levels to a lesser extent during lockdowns, perhaps as a result of working in essential services.
And the model also showed that these high infection rates in the disadvantaged areas were driven by just a few categories of venue, such as full-service restaurants. Now, compared with more affluent areas, the venues tended to be smaller, and that led to greater customer densities. In other words, more people in a smaller area. And in addition to this, people traveling to these venues tended to stay longer.
For example, grocery stores in low-income areas had 59% more people per square foot than in higher-income areas, and their customers stayed 17% longer on average.
As a result, the model found that the infection risk for low-income individuals visiting a grocery store was about twice as high compared with a high-income individual. The researcher's standard infection model, in other words, predicts how people transfer between four categories. Carmen's going to tell us those categories.
The first category are those that are susceptible to infection. Second are those people exposed to infection. There are those that are indeed infectious and removed, such as those who have recovered, self-isolated, or even died.
The researchers also took into account the floor space of the venues that they visited and their purpose, such as a place of worship or a grocery store. And other information was taken into account, such as the local infection and the death rates.
Still, many researchers from around the world say that we have to be careful making decisions from this data, as what may apply in one population may not necessarily apply elsewhere.
Remember that the research did not take into account children or those persons in prison. And another question has popped up concerning the COVID-19 pandemic, and that is, who is immune without having an infection? Scientists have actually discovered antibodies that react to the new coronavirus in blood samples donated prior to the start of the pandemic. And that fact is important. That at least suggests that some people may have at least a degree of pre-existing immunity to the new virus. Remember that not everyone who comes into contact with SARS-CoV-2 develops COVID-19.
Research has been done at the Francis Crick Institute in London and at the University College London, which may explain at least in part why some people can fight off a SARS-CoV-2 infection better than others.
The research team originally set out to develop a high-sensitivity test to detect antibodies to the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Scientists can use this type of test to establish whether a person has antibodies after they had COVID-19, which is a key piece of information for those trying to establish how long immunity may last after SARS-CoV-2 infection.
As a part of their work, the scientists used serum samples provided by people who did not have COVID-19. And to their surprise, they found antibodies that reacted to SARS-CoV-2 in some of the samples. The researchers described a scientific theory that exposure to any of the common human coronaviruses, which can cause the common cold, may lead to immunity against the other common human coronaviruses. Now, this type of immunity is called immune cross-reactivity.
You may not know that COVID is not the only nor the first coronavirus found to affect humans. In fact, there are four seasonal common human coronaviruses, all of which mostly cause mild disease.
The vast majority of people have an infection with at least one of these viruses at some point. I think that this is really important to know. Scientists already know that our bodies do not build up long-lasting immunity to these particular viruses.
That is why a person can contract an infection with a common human coronavirus more than once in their lifetime. So, the question really boils down to whether a previous exposure to a common human coronavirus provides at least temporary protection against SARS-CoV-2.
Over the past several months, you've probably seen dozens of depictions of what the microscopic virus looks like, with its round nature, with spikes jutting out of all sides of the viral molecule. The antibodies that recognize a part of the protein that makes up the spikes may actually provide immune cross-reactivity. Carmen is going to give you a picture here on the radio of what this viral spike is really made up of.
The spike of this coronavirus is made of two parts, also called subunits by the scientists. We will continue to call the parts so each part performs a different job.
The part called the S1 subunit allows the virus to latch onto cells, and this part is relatively diverse among coronaviruses. But then we come to the S2 part. It is this portion of the spike that lets the virus into the cells, and it is the more similar one among these viruses. Research has shown that the similarities between the common cold coronaviruses and SARS-CoV-2 is sufficient so that some antibodies can work against both. Now, since researchers love statistics, let me give you some. In a group of 50 blood samples from pregnant people from May 2018, the researchers found that 10% had cross-reacting antibodies.
In a further experiment, the team analyzed 13 additional samples from adults who had recently had an infection with a common cold coronavirus. Of these, only one sample had cross-reacting antibodies.
Taking this all into account, it has been reported that a little over 5%, that's about 1 in 20, had SARS-CoV-2 cross-reacting antibodies, with the median age of the donors being, around 51 years. Now, you may be saying to yourself, 5%? Well, that's a small number. Why did relatively few people have cross-reacting antibodies, given that infections with common human coronaviruses is so common among people? There seems to be several requirements before cross-reactivity can occur.
One such requirement may involve how often a person has an infection with a common human coronavirus. The frequency is highest in children and adolescents.
Children are more regularly exposed to other coronaviruses, so they are affected less when a new one arrives. And the researchers looked into the data even more deeply. The results showed that children are much more likely to have these cross-reactive antibodies than adults.
There are still many more unknowns which require further research. For example, exactly how is immunity to one coronavirus modifying by exposure to another?
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Enough of COVID-19 news for today. Let's get on to something else. How about diabetes? Remember that there are really two types of diabetes mellitus. Well, there's also a diabetes insipidus, but really diabetes mellitus and diabetes insipidus are really two entirely different diseases. When I say two types of diabetes, here I mean diabetes type 1 and diabetes type 2. Over the years, there have been other names for these, such as juvenile diabetes and adult onset diabetes.
For a long time, most patients responded to taking an oral medication called metformin. However, recently many patients are no longer responding to metformin and are taking a combination of two newer drugs.
In type 1 diabetes, most sufferers have to take injections of insulin, since insulin helps regulate the amount of glucose, that's sugar, circulating in the blood. And in type 1 diabetics, there is no insulin being produced by the body in response to an intake of sugar. But in type 2 diabetes, the body does not produce enough insulin, or its cells no longer respond effectively to the hormone insulin, and it could be both.
In the long term, in both types of diabetes, the high blood glucose levels can cause a wide range of debilitating and potentially life-threatening complications.
These include high blood pressure, damage to organs such as the heart and kidneys, nerve damage, and even blindness. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, type 2 diabetes affects more than 30 million individuals in the United States, and it accounts for over 90% of all cases of diabetes.
type 2 diabetes mostly affects people over the age of 45, but in recent decades, rates of type 2 diabetes in children, teenagers, and young adults have increased in the U.S.
Lifestyle changes can control or even reverse the condition, and doctors also prescribe drugs to stabilize patients' blood glucose levels. The first-line treatment has been metformin. As we said earlier, in some patients, the drug's efficacy can decline over time, necessitating alternate treatments. So a drug combination using two of the newer drugs called exenatide and dapagliflozin have been used by those patients when the response to metformin was low or none.
After 52 weeks of trials, the results showed that the combination was safe and continued to be more effective than either drug alone. In addition to stabilizing blood glucose levels, the drug combination was associated with lower blood pressure and body weight.
The study went on to show that the combination of drugs remained safe and effective 2 years after treatment had begun. So let's take a look at both of the drugs that we mentioned. First, there is exenatide.
This drug works in three ways. First, it promotes insulin secretion, and second, it reduces the release of glucose from the liver. Finally, it increases the feeling of fullness after a meal.
The second drug is called dapagliflozin, and it boosts the amount of glucose that's excreted in urine. So both these drugs work synergistically, meaning together, to help control a type 2 diabetes patient's glucose levels and other measures associated with diabetes. In a study, a weekly injection of the exenatide and a daily oral dose of dapagliflozin were given. After 2 years, 431 patients remained in the trial, and most of the participants who did drop out did so because they did not want to sign up to an extension of the trial.
In patients who took both drugs, there were improvements in blood glucose levels after fasting and 2 hours after eating, and reductions in body weight and systolic blood pressure.
And now for another change of topic. This one related to the exposure, or I should say overexposure, to works of art. It's called Stendhal syndrome, and it apparently is a real disease. What if you were so overwhelmed by the beauty of a work of art that it made you physically and mentally unwell? That is Stendhal syndrome.
Just about 2 years ago, a press headline came out that a man had while admiring the famous painting by the Renaissance artist Sandro Botticelli, The Birth of Venus.
The implication behind the headlines was not that the event had been a coincidence, but in fact that the artwork's staggering beauty had caused the heart attack. Now, this may seem bizarre, and you may be smirking in front of your radio, but there is a fairly long history behind the notion that art can be so overwhelming as to cause physical illness. The term Stendhal syndrome was named by an Italian psychiatrist in 1989.
Initially, a doctor by the name of Magherini identified a unique phenomenon after noticing that there was a huge amount of people, at least for an Italian hospital, being admitted after having experienced feelings of unease in the presence of Florence's monuments, museums, and art galleries.
This physician believed that this could be found in Stendhal's writings about Italy, and so she coined the expression the Stendhal syndrome. The French writer Stendhal, in his travel memoir called A Journey from Milan to Reggio, which he wrote around 1817, stated, and I'm going to quote this one, "My soul, affected by the very notion of being in Florence and by the proximity of those great men whose tombs I had just beheld, was already in a state of trance.
Absorbed in the contemplation of sublime beauty, I had attained to that supreme degree of sensibility where the divine intimation of art merged with the impassioned sensuality of emotion."
The sense of awe experienced by being in the proximity of so many impressive historical and art monuments allegedly gave the writer heart palpitations and made him feel faint. And getting back to the real-world modern medicine, this syndrome apparently only affects tourists.
It can be defined as a psychosomatic, meaning both mental and physical, response experience while facing aesthetic beauty, but not natural beauty.
Initially, Dr. Magarini identified three main types of symptoms in Stendhal syndrome: altered perception of sounds or colors, an increased sense of anxiety, guilt, or persecution, depressive anxiety, a sense of inadequacy, or conversely, a sense of euphoria or omnipotence, panic attacks, and physiological symptoms of heightened anxiety, such as chest pain. Now, Dr. Magarini went on to suggest that this syndrome affects mainly, again, I'm going to quote this section, very sensitive individuals who become more easily affected by objects of art that they encounter while abroad traveling in a foreign country.
From a cultural point of view, Dr. Cameletti, another physician, believes that this shock is a symbol of the gap between being familiar with famous artworks, thanks to their representation in the media, and seeing the actual works in person.
So the question remains, is Stendhal syndrome a real disease? Two scientists observed that volunteers who found certain paintings beautiful had increased activity in the medial orbitofrontal cortex of the brain, and that's an area that forms part of the brain's reward system. Interesting.
This is a circuit that becomes active during desirable activities that, at their core, help promote survival. These desirable activities include eating and having sex.
The overactivation of certain brain areas in individuals who may be predisposed to or at risk of mental health problems may thus help explain phenomena like the Stendhal syndrome. Now, while this syndrome seems to affect specifically tourists who visit Florence, researchers have observed similar symptoms in tourists who travel to Paris or Jerusalem.
Also, 63 Japanese individuals who had been visiting Paris became hospitalized in France between 1988 and 2004 and required psychiatric treatment after developing delusions or paranoia, seemingly as a result of their disappointment that Paris was not the perfect, dreamy, idealized city they had imagined.
So another syndrome was born, named appropriately Paris syndrome. And if that were not enough, another related phenomenon now called Jerusalem syndrome refers to the emergence of religious excitement in tourists who visit the holy places found in Jerusalem and its surroundings. Now, for our final bit of weekly news, we have the results of a study looking at the use of turmeric for chronic pain.
From the treatment of digestive issues to reducing pain and inflammation in rheumatologic conditions, the root of the flowering plant turmeric, whose Latin name is curcuma longa extract, has been used.
So we finally have an actual well-designed trial to show that turmeric, best known in the United States as a ginger-like cooking spice, could potentially serve as a clinical alternative to existing pain treatments in conditions such as osteoarthritis. Curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric. Its efficacy in treating acute pain has been well known, and its side effects compares favorably to existing pain medications.
In the current double-blind, single-center study, randomized patients with symptomatic knee osteoarthritis and knee infusion received either two capsules of turmeric or matched placebo per day for 12 weeks.
Primary outcomes were change in knee pain.
Results show turmeric was more effective in reducing pain compared with placebo, but did not change effusion, synovitis, volume, or cartilage composition. Turmeric also showed greater change in knee pain than placebo.
So maybe there is a place in medicine for using turmeric in long-term osteoarthritis patients for providing safe and effective pain relief.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com.
HeyDoc.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana.
We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.